We're talking about the development of non-addictive alternatives for opioids here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The opioid epidemic is taking a huge toll on our economy, more than $500 billion a year. That's when you take into account healthcare bills, criminal justice costs, and lost worker productivity. And a Milwaukee-area pharmaceutical is in early trials on a new opioid alternative medication. Do you think developing alternatives to opioid painkillers is an important step to take in addressing the opioid crisis? What do you want to know about the future of pain meds that could replace opioids? We're at 800-642-1234. Dennis Torko is vice president of CMX 20. Dennis, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, tell us about this medication your company is currently developing that would market as an alternative to opioid painkillers.
CMX-20 is a non-opioid pain medication that has no addiction characteristics, no side effects like the opioids have. In addition, it is more efficacious than acetaminophen, which is Tylenol on the commercial market, without the toxicity to the liver effects of Tylenol. So it's a very, very clean molecule.
So this would be a non-narcotic painkiller. Can you explain what that means?
That means that when you take the drug, you have no feelings of taking the drug, sort of like taking aspirin or something. So you have no feelings of euphoria like you would with an opiate. And you don't have any of the side effects like constipation or dizziness or those kind of things that the opiates produce.
But there must be some type of side effects that are popping up here. What are you seeing?
Well, we've done this with hundreds of people, and we've had no adverse events, which is the term in the pharmaceutical industry for bad things happening. With our human population at this point, so it's been very clean.
And the trials you've done have been on patients who are post-op after knee or hip replacement surgery.
Go ahead.
So, what types of pain are you trying to remedy here?
Well, eventually the drug will be a broad class pain reliever that will address multiple kinds of pain. Our trials are focused on post-knee and post-hip replacement at this point.
We're talking with Dennis Torko. He is vice president of CMX-20. That's a Milwaukee-area pharmaceutical developing a non-narcotic pain reliever. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you need opioid painkillers for chronic pain? Has it become more difficult for you to get a prescription in the past few years? Would you opt for a painkiller that isn't an opioid or narcotic? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Dennis, these drugs are being marketed as less addictive than opioids commonly prescribed for pain like OxyContin and Vicodin and Demerol. And at this point in your research, what do you know about the potential risk of abuse and dependence for this type of drug?
Well, our early findings would support the hypothesis, at least, that there is no addiction characteristics associated with our drug because there's no feeling of euphoria when you take the drug. You don't feel a drug when you take it. The pain goes away, but you don't feel anything different.
Give us the backstory on how this drug came to be and how your company formed.
The research that was originally done was done at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. The research team then took those findings and went through approximately 100 different iterations of the molecule that was discovered in the original research and came up with a molecule that was 10 times as efficacious as the original research produced. And also much longer lasting. And it was the 20th molecule of the 100 we looked at, so we named the company CMX-20.
And so you've been at this for about a decade now.
We're just coming up on 10 years. It takes a long time to develop a drug in the United States, and we respect that because the FDA is very careful about what happens in the general population, and we work closely with them.
Well, let's talk about what phase you're in. The oral version of this medication is in phase 2 trials for FDA approval. What does that mean?
That means that we are in human trials that are focused on specific pain indications, and the results of those human trials, assuming they're successful, then lead to what's called phase 3, which is a broad general population trial that will involve hundreds, if not thousands, of people across the world.
And so right now you're working on this in Australia, I understand?
Yeah, we're doing the clinical trials in Australia. The Australian government provides a tax credit, if you will, for companies operating there and doing human clinicals that rebates about half of the cost of the trial, so it's very economically efficient for us to do that.
Well, let's go to the phones now with Ted joining us in Madison. Hi, Ted. What's on your mind here? Ted, can you hear us? Yeah, go ahead.
I'm saying, with thousands of people, you know, overdosing on opiates every year, I was just curious, if this came to the market, do you see that this could replace, you know, opiates? Could they put this on the shelves and take opiates off the shelves?
Yes, Ted, it's very possible that that CMX-20 over the long term would have the effect of replacing opioids. Certainly would significantly reduce the use of opioids in the treatment of pain.
And so you also have an intravenous version of this medication. Where do you stand with developing that?
That's in phase 1. So we are making sure that we have all the safety characteristics of use in humans addressed. And then taking that on to phase 2 once those trials are done. You know, in the hospitals today, there are as many as 20,000 deaths a year from hospital procedures where opioids are used in the post-surgical treatment process. So even there, we can make a significant impact in the human toll opioids take.
Well, right. You see this crisis all around you. Does that make it feel more urgent to you to find something that you can bring to market here?
I would say that the needs are pressing. We're very excited about our CMX-20. We have a lot of work to do, but we're very confident that we'll bring to market a drug that will be very efficacious and helpful to millions of people.
When you say you have a lot of work to do, what are the challenges? What's ahead for getting this to market?
We have to get final approval from the FDA for bringing a drug to market. In addition, we will be finding a pharmaceutical company partner to help us bring the drug to market. So all those things take time and effort.
Well, Dennis, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, you're quite welcome. Happy to be here.
Dennis Torko is vice president of CMX-20. That's a Milwaukee-area pharmaceutical company that's developing a non-narcotic pain reliever currently in phase 2 trials in Australia. Coming up, we continue discussing the opioid crisis with a look at chronic pain management and what physicians can do to safely manage prescriptions for painkillers. That's when we come back in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the opioid crisis and chronic pain management on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. After several years of controversy, the CDC this month clarified its opioid prescribing guidelines. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said its three-year-old recommendations were not intended to deny clinically appropriate treatment to patients who suffer acute pain from conditions like cancer and hospice care. The guidelines target primary care physicians because family docs write the vast majority of prescriptions for painkillers. What questions do you have about prescription painkillers? Do you try to avoid these prescriptions and ensure pain and endure pain because you worry about addiction? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your question. Dr. Alaa Abda El Sayed is medical director for the UW Health Pain Services and the UW Pain Clinic. He's author of Chronic Pain, The Patient and Family Journey. Dr. Abda El Sayed, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So we just talked to a Milwaukee-based pharmaceutical that's really trying to develop a solution here, a non-narcotic alternative to opioids for treating pain. Are there other drugs like this in development?
So there are multiple drugs in development trying to establish alternative to opioids, which can help reducing the prescription of opioids, hopefully in the next few years.
Do we see that this is a short, that the timeline to get to some type of alternative is shorter than longer?
So to some extent, I think there is more movement to developing those drugs now after all what happened with the opioids epidemic and shedding the light in the media on its hazards, which happened only in the past few years. But also there are actually established classes of medications that still can be used to treat chronic pain before moving to opioids. So we're still in relatively an okay shape.
What would be those class of medications that would be a bridge to opioids?
So I would call them first a choice for treating chronic pain before discussing the potential of using opioids. These are the some of the antidepressant medications, anti-seizure medications, over-the-counter medications. And actually, reported in literature, those drugs have very good evidence for the use in chronic pain, actually much stronger than opioids.
Are these alternatives helpful most of the time, some of the time? How predictable is it that you're going to have chronic pain that is managed?
I'll say they work actually most of the time. In addition to many other things patient can do, like physical therapy, occupational therapy, being active, seeing sometimes a pain psychologist specialized in teaching patient to cope with pain. So doing like four or five things next to the medication can be definitely very effective.
Oh, so you have like multiple things going on to try to combat this pain.
Correct. And I think pain in its management now is moving to be a multidisciplinary approach, not only a medication or an injection.
We're talking about chronic pain management with Dr. Alaa Abda El Sayed, and he is medical director for the UW Health Pain Services and UW Pain Clinic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know been prescribed opioid painkillers? Did it lead to dependence, or were you okay? Do you need opioid painkillers for chronic pain or other kinds of pain? You can join in, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Joel now, joining us from Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, Joel.
Good morning. Good morning. I had a special early to get this program, so bear with me if I stumble a little bit. But that said, I've been on opioid oxycodone for a number of years, and most recently, well, I can't say recently, it will be 6 years come June. I was in a catastrophic auto accident here in Ironwood where they had to heal me from the hospital in Ironwood to Duluth and put my left side back together when I was trapped in the car that they had to cut me out of due to the accident. Now, that said, after a recovery in Duluth at hospital at St. Mary's, and two doctors worked diligently to help me get at least going to a point where I have a destination to recover. Okay.
Joel, when as you take OxyContin, are you plateauing? Are you taking more or less?
No, the doctor that prescribed it, apparently the hospital clinic here in Iowa has been forced by the federal government to cut back, I believe the story goes, on the number of pills that they're going to allow you to take per month. I used to take 3 a day every 8 hours. Now it's cut back.
Now, Joel, I want to pause right there and let you go ahead, doctor.
Yep. Thank you, Joel, for calling us this morning. And I would like to clarify that so the guidelines are not meant for physicians to stop prescribing opioids. And I know that in certain areas and practices, we're going now to the opposite extreme of no opioids. And that shouldn't be the case. What happened before is that there have been overprescription of opioids, which led to significant mortalities in the U.S. Among all age groups. And the guidelines meant now to just alarm people that there is a problem and you need to do risk assessment tools, assess the patient who need opioids, because some patients still need opioids as cancer patients, palliative care patients, or chronic pain patients who failed all other modalities and show no high risk by assessment tools of being on opioids. And again, you can justify the doses and do urine drug screens, opioid agreements, monitor the use to make sure they are not being misused.
If you're on opioids for years and years and years, in Joel's case, 6 years or more, does the effect of taking that drug wear a little bit on your system and also is not as effective anymore?
It is exactly what you said. There is multiple phenomena that happen with the use of opioids. One of them is tolerance, which means you need higher doses of the drug to achieve same effect. So it's nothing about the patient seeking or anything. That's the nature of the body.
And so in terms of physicians who have a patient on OxyContin, do they try to figure out then what's the next step or take them off, or knowing that it's not going to be as effective in years to come?
That's an excellent point. I think it's about determining goals and see, that's fine, I'm going to wean down OxyContin to a lower dose. But then what else I will be doing to manage pain? That's when the role of the other medications, classes, interventions, and the other modalities to be used, so to allow at least for this decrease to be doable.
Sounds like in chronic pain management, you always have to be moving and thinking one step ahead.
Correct. There should be always a plan. It's not about looking at what we do now, but a plan for the future and what kind of medication the patient will be on for how many years.
You know, when we look at the opioid crisis, there is a lot of finger-pointing right now. Finger-pointing at pharmaceuticals, finger-pointing at physicians writing prescriptions, and even patients who are trapped in the middle of this. Where do we get out of this?
This is very unfortunate, and it's happening every day. I think it's about now just taking a step back for every provider, every patient, every company manufacturing those drugs and their alternatives, establish communication goals, and start working with those patients, because ultimately that's our goal, is to get our patients into safe level of opioids and have the community to be safe as well. So establishing good management plans and consulting with specialists in pain medicine who might provide other tools to allow this to happen. We have been helping several primary care providers to do this. It has been a very successful experience.
And primary care providers are writing these prescriptions for painkillers, family doctors. Do you find that their practices have changed over time?
Definitely has changed with all the regulations. They became more concerned about prescribing opioids and they started weaning down their patients.
We're talking about the opioid crisis and the path forward for managing chronic pain. Dr. Alaa Abdeh El-Sayed is our guide. And you can join in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So last week, the company that makes Suboxone was charged with fraud and conspiracy for marketing its products as less addictive and safer than generic brands. How do you broach this as a physician when you see things like this happen?
So, again, this is very unfortunate, and this is not the first time this happens. Actually, one of the reasons probably we have an opioid epidemic at their camp. Companies in the past who came up with products and said the same, they are not addictive, they are safer. And over the years, we recognize now that they are highly addictive. So I read actually about this recent claim, and I think for years in practice, we kind of all saw and knew that patients are getting addicted to Suboxone as well. So definitely, it's misleading, I'd say this.
We're talking with Dr. Alaa Abda El Sayed. He's our guide. Your questions, your stories are welcome as we explore the opioid crisis at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know been prescribed painkillers? Did it lead to dependence? Or were you okay on the other side? Or do you need opioid painkillers for chronic pain or other types of pain? Has it become more difficult for you to get a prescription in the past few years? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll continue this conversation on the opioid epidemic right after a news update here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the opioid epidemic here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. U.S. health officials warned doctors last week not to abruptly stop prescribing opioid painkillers to patients who are taking them for chronic pain ailments like backaches. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration said it will add some verbiage to labels on how to taper opioid painkillers like OxyContin and Vicodin and dozens of generic painkillers. Closer to home, the battle is not only with legal prescriptions, but also with illicit drugs like heroin and fentanyl. Are you a healthcare provider or an addiction specialist? Do you think developing alternatives to opioids is what we should focus on? Or do you think we should focus on other things when it comes to addressing addiction and the opioid crisis? We're at 800-642-1234. Join in by email at ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Alaa Abda El Sayed is medical director for the UW Health Pain Services and the UW Pain Clinic, and he stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now with Chris joining us from Adams. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. I have two autoimmune diseases. Both of them have intractable pain conditions attached to them. I'm in all over body pain pretty much 24/7. And I was on a course of OxyContin at one point to the great frustration of my doctor. It did nothing. I also have tried every kind of NSAID, every kind of lesser opiate drug. Nothing works. And so I have had to move into the realm of alternative therapies. And one of the things that has really helped me a lot is going on an anti-inflammatory diet. The other thing is CBD oil, and there are other alternatives that people can try. For instance, acupuncture, deep muscle massage, and the doctor is right. I mean, exercise in a warm water pool will also help. But people really need to think about the source of their pain and not just masking it. And most traditional medications try to mask the pain. If you eat properly, and that really means radically altering your diet and seeking out some of these alternative therapies, you can get away from dependence upon the drugs.
Chris, thanks for the call. What should we know about alternative therapies and nutrition?
So I'm glad Chris actually made my job easy here, because she concluded the whole thing. I mean, diet in itself, it can be actually a big contributor to development or cure of chronic pain.
Cure for chronic pain.
Yep. So significant changes in diet have been reported to improve several pain conditions, because simply your diet has sometimes initiate inflammation in the body and induce chronic pain. And sometimes the actually healthy diet will have anti-inflammatory properties, which can actually help with chronic pain. So very important to pick up the right food and, again, do the physical therapy, try the alternatives. And Chris is just a success story. I think if people do those things, they will have better efficacy than just being on opioids.
She also mentioned exercise besides eating well. What impact does exercise have?
So exercise is very important. Overall, that's what we call non-pharmacological treatment. So basically, before even starting pills, we try to work with our patients by non-medication methods. So exercising basically strengthens the muscles, allow the body to be more active, function in a better way. It improves the well-being of the whole body systems as well. And also, for there are exercises for every single pain condition, whether back pain, knee pain, to allow strengthening the muscles around the painful area, which can reduce the function of the painful joint and allow for the muscles to help out.
You know, companies, the opioid abuse is certainly big business. These prescriptions are very costly. Narcan, brand name version of naloxone, that the drug that reverses overdoses, it's tripled in price over the past couple years. How do you square the fact that people's lives are on the line with the fact that drug companies are still companies and are seeking profits?
It's a very complex, actually, point, because companies spend significant amounts of money on research to go through the FDA and get their drugs to the market. I think they spend millions. And when they launch their drugs, they look for collecting their money back. I think there should be some way that those drugs get maybe fast-tracked by the FDA and studied, under different process, so they can get to a market cheaper, because these are essential medications that people do need.
Let's go to Eleanor now in Beloit. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi, oh, yes. Good morning.
What's on your mind here?
Actually, I was listening to everything the doctor just said and the previous lady. I agree with her completely. I've been to the sense of, I also have autoimmune disorders that cause chronic pain and inflammation in all my joints. But my thing is, in the beginning, when opioids kind of first came out, like doctors said, doctors were prescribing a lot. And when the epidemic of overdoses came about, they kind of just stopped everybody and shut everybody down. And then, you know, if you're still in pain, then they look at you like, why are you in pain? And they kind of categorize you as a pill seeker, an addict.
Eleanor, do you feel like you've had to make a strong case for yourself when you're in the doctor's office?
Yes. Now I'm kind of, I feel like the narration has changed, that I've been labeled as a seeker. But the alternative, like the previous lady was talking about, like acupuncture, massage therapy, those things aren't covered by insurance.
Are you on painkillers right now?
No. Basically, I do therapy and chiropractic visits.
Eleanor, thanks so much. Yeah, thanks so much for the call. Yeah, doctor, do we start labeling people who actually need this type of painkiller? And is it more difficult to get these prescriptions?
It is. And I kind of agree that in certain areas or certain patients in ER settings and other, they do label patients as seekers. And I think we have to be very careful using this word, because it does hurt patients. And probably in most of the time, that's not the case. These are just patients who were prescribed opioids, became dependent on the medication to treat their pain. And if they are not showing any noncompliance, I don't think by any means they should be called seekers.
Stephen from Spring Grove, Illinois, emailed to say that his mom was in a car accident and became addicted to opioids due to the car accident. She had previous problems with these drugs. Doctors didn't know that then, and that then pulled back. Because of that, she died from an overdose. How are we accounting for those that get pulled from opioids and get these drugs on the street then?
So I think prevention is the best way here, by just doing some assessment tools before starting opioids. Because if the patient at high risk, probably we shouldn't start opioids, or we should very closely monitor opioids and have again goals and stop date and introduce many other alternatives for the treatment, so to avoid this unnecessary accident.
So you really have to know these patients well.
Very well, because sometimes there are many factors that can just make opioids not a good option, not only the patient, but there are, for example, families that have kids who have addiction problem, and that has endangered people's life before, because the son will try to attack the mother, steal the medications. So we have to be aware of all those dynamics in the patient and surrounding environment to make sure everybody's safe.
We're talking with Dr. Ala Abda El Sayed and about the opioid crisis. He is medical director for the UW Health Pain Services and the UW Pain Clinic. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What is your concern about these painkillers and opioids in general? Do you have a family member who is trying to get off opioids? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Sura now in Viola. Hi, Sura.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a friend who had been addicted to heroin when she was young, and a couple of years ago, in her 50s, she had gone on methadone, and that was working for her, and she was, you know, functional, had a job, she had raised her son, and everything was going well, and then the opioid crisis information came out, and her doctor scaled her back from her methadone. And she tried it for a while. It wasn't working, and she was getting more and more anxious and panicky and, you know, was asking her doctor, can you up the methadone? And, of course, she's not getting high from the methadone. It's just helping her function. And he refused, and so she went and got heroin and ended up overdosing and dying. So I hope that, you know, doctors now are not, I mean, just what your guest said about, you know, you need to know your patient and listen to them and trust that they sometimes know better for themselves than you. And I, you know, this is something that just didn't need to happen.
Sarah, thank you for that story. Very difficult there. And just as you were talking about, you need to know the patient.
That's exactly it. I think it's extremely important to know the patient. And this is probably one of the most difficult scenarios we hear frequently, that you already have history addiction and the high potential, and then you put on other medications and you get in this discussion about it. And again, I think trying the too many other alternatives probably can help such patients.
As we start to wrap up here, you've worked in this environment a long time now. What do you grapple with? What's the most difficult part of your job?
There are multiple, actually, difficult parts, particularly with the media work and regulations and the misinterpretation of those regulations. I think we need to just support our colleagues and try to have people seek help, the providers themselves seek help when they are struggling with a patient for the management of pain, because I think, again, prevention is the key here. The more we try all the other alternatives and not get patients on opioids, the less the problem will be in the next few years.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Ala Abda El Sayed is medical director for the UW Health Pain Services and the UW Pain Clinic. He's author of the book Chronic Pain, The Patient and Family Journey. Coming up, the devastating fire at Notre Dame was extinguished yesterday, and now it's figuring out how the medieval cathedral can be salvaged, and restoration could take many years. Let's talk about the cathedral and what happens next with a UW historian as our guide. That's coming up in a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It took a little more than 1 hour Monday for Notre Dame's spire to fall and most of its roof to give way in a monstrous fire that broke out at this historic house of worship.
Breaking news out of Paris. The roof of Notre Dame Cathedral is engulfed in flames, including the spire.
The facade was preserved. Its bell towers are intact. But what happens to this iconic structure, the point from which all distances in Paris are measured? Have you ever visited the Notre Dame Cathedral? What was that experience like? How would you describe it? Does Notre Dame hold special meaning to you? We're at 800-642-1234. Suzanne Dazan is a UW Madison history professor. She's author or editor of 4 books on French history, including The French Revolution in Global Perspective. Suzanne, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Well, people around the world are mourning the extensive damage at Notre Dame. This is from CBS.
Newspaper writers have been trying to put those emotions into words. This headline reads, "Tears." This one reads, "Disaster."
Why does this fire at the cathedral surface so many emotions?
Well, I think it is a site where many great historical events have occurred, but I think that it represents the human ability, and for the French ability to create beauty. It's this stunning and majestic cathedral that you sort of can't believe was built back in the 1100s and the 1200s by ordinary people. I also think it for those people who are Catholic, it represents the power of the sacred there. And I also think for the French, it represents their roots in tradition. The French are, can I speak about this a bit just from the French point of view? I think they're extremely proud as producers of culture that they spread to other parts of the world. And the cathedral certainly represents that ability to create beauty. I also think the French imagine themselves as very much out there as innovators, revolutionaries, with the French Revolution and the multiple revolutions across the 19th century, with avant-garde art, with the Eiffel Tower, this icon of modernity. But in some ways, their ability to innovate and be rebellious is grounded by the deep roots of tradition. And I think, you know, the 850 years of Notre Dame represents that also. And the ability to survive all kinds of difficulties.
To prevail. You've visited Notre Dame. You're a French historian.
Yes.
But you also have a very personal story about this place. Can you tell us about your father's decision there?
Sure. My father was actually a Belgian immigrant. And before he came to the United States, he was a priest. And in the 1940s, he was in Paris at the end of the war, struggling with the decision of whether to leave the priesthood, which was not a light decision in that time period. It meant that he would be bringing shame on his family. It meant that he would basically have to leave. He'd have to disappear and invent a new last name, which he did. And the story goes that one night he was walking the streets of Paris, wrestling with this decision, and he went into Notre Dame, and there he had the epiphany that he had to leave. So therefore, I exist. But I think if one puts it in a broader perspective, I think that Notre Dame is a space in which many people, not just my father, but other people have had deep spiritual or personal experiences that the space made possible.
Yeah. People have these personal discoveries in Notre Dame, and it's also a place for collective experience. What does this grand cathedral tell us about our own inner possibility?
Well, I think one message that it definitely conveys is the message of resilience and the possibility of reinventing oneself. I mean, I think one of the things that's striking about Notre Dame as a space is that it has endured various attacks, right? There are two moments in French history, the 16th century, the battles between the Protestants and the Catholics, when the Protestants were smashing various Catholic statues, the Revolution of 1789, when you have attacks on great monuments of particularly religious monuments, the world wars, the cathedral has survived all of these different attacks. But it's also been it's really been a space where the French reinvent themselves. I work on the French Revolution, and it's not an accident that during the Revolution, when the revolutionaries were trying to imagine, you know, how can we become an entirely new people, that they chose Notre Dame as the cathedral where they would not only commit destruction, but also creation. They tried to create a festival of reason there and turn it into a temple of reason. This was horrific for some people, but it was also for others a sign of hope. Anyway, I could go on, but I won't.
We're talking with Suzanne Dazan, who is UW-Madison history professor. She's author or editor of 4 books on French history, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Does the Notre Dame Cathedral have special meaning to you? What was your reaction after you learned of this week's fire? You can share your story, email ideas at WPR.org. When we look at the fire itself, how has the structure's age contributed to the strong flames the world witnessed this week?
Well, I think, like a lot of people, on Monday when I first heard Notre Dame was on fire, I thought, you know, how is that possible? It's made of stone. But it's clear now that under the wooden roof there's a huge amount of wooden structure known as the forest, which are different beams that were holding up not only the roof but contributing to the structure itself. And I know that yesterday when my family was texting a bit about the fire, my brother texted a photo from when he and his family about 10 years ago walked up the bell towers, a photo of some of those wooden timbers, that some of which were, you know, 800, 850 years old and therefore were quite ready to burst into flame. Also, the inside of that spire that fell so dramatically, that spire was reconstructed in the 19th century when Viollet-le-Duc, in the middle of the century, was restoring Notre Dame after the attacks of the French Revolution and also in the aftermath of the 1830 Revolution. And inside that spire was wood as well. So all of that old wood that had been carefully protected from the elements by repeated restorations, all of that was, in a sense, ready or capable of going up in flame in the disastrous way that it did.
And another restoration here was underway or
yes.
in the works,
right.
Because this is something that you have to continually restore in order to keep it alive.
Yeah, that's right. So the restoration project itself, with, you know, electrical equipment, with various chemicals, made it possible for the area to be more flammable.
This is considered one of the finest examples of French Gothic architecture mm-hmm. around the world. What is it about this historic structure that stands out?
Well, I think it's really the architectural beauty of it, the staying power of it. It was, in medieval times, you know, the heart of this vibrant community where there would have been buildings, houses right up against it that were cleared out in the 19th century. I think its power as a space of the sacred. I remember once when I was a kid and we were living in Paris during one of my dad's sabbaticals, we went to Notre Dame during Easter Vigil. And during Easter Vigil, one person lights a candle that in a church that's completely dark, the way it would have been in the medieval times. And then the next person lights their candle from that candle, and that gradually spreads throughout the whole church. So the church gradually becomes lit, and I think that kind of evoked for me as a kid the way it must have been during medieval times, this glimmering beauty. Mm. So I also think Paris is a city that it doesn't have a huge number of skyscrapers, so Notre Dame sitting on the Ile de la Cité, right on the river, right between the left and the right bank, it really stands out architecturally right there.
As we close here, you've studied French history for decades, many dark moments in history. What hope does Paris have right now?
Well, I think the fact that there is such a rush to rebuild is a statement about, well, the human desire to preserve what it's created that's aesthetically beautiful and spiritually beautiful. I think there will be a bit of a political struggle within France as to who claims, you know, Macron is positioning himself, of course, claiming that he's going to rebuild it. But it may also be a force for unity, I hope, within France.
Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Suzanne Dazan is a professor of history with the UW-Madison. She's author of books on French history, including The French Revolution and Global Perspective. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.